Hello and welcome to another edition of the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Eve Dombra, art historian and chair of the Department of Art at Vassar College. Eve is with us today to talk about the subject of her book entitled Roman Women, published this year by Cambridge University Press. Welcome, Eve.
Hi, Tom.
There have been a slate of books published in the last year or so by various academic presses about women in ancient Rome, but these generally take as their subjects the more prominent women of Roman history and literature, such as Cleopatra and women of the Julio-Claudian and Flavian imperial families. But your book stands out as something different from these in that it attempts to give us a picture of what the lives of ordinary Roman women were like, including slaves, merchants, matrons, and prostitutes, whom these other texts marginalize or ignore altogether. And I wonder if you could talk about this. Is this reflective of a particular view of history or philosophy concerning the practice of history writing on your part?
Well, of course, it is intentional. My field, being half in art history and half in classics, has always been traditionally concerned with those on top, the reigning families, the emperors, and for women it would be the emperor's wives and families. So my interest is the texture of daily life, more ordinary concerns. I think some feminist scholarship has looked at institutions. I can't say that I'm a pioneer in that, yeah. Particularly the family and marriage. But the unnamed, those of the lower social level, is important to me. There is some precedent in this, in that since my field is based on archaeological studies, mm-hmm. in any kind of excavated site of a Roman city or a habitation, what you would find that has been preserved over the centuries are the most humble of artifacts, yeah. for women's life, weaving equipment, spindles, whorls, ceramics, pottery, right, the everyday kitchenware of the household. You know, fine jewelry or large chunks of marble statuary are much more rare, and that's yeah. what traditional archaeologists or art historians have wanted, you know, the collectors, the treasure. But most sites are littered with, you know, mundane debris, which actually tells you what people did in terms of economic development and, you know, how they lived, what yeah. they ate, even bones of animals or fish spines, that type of thing. So you might say the majority of archaeological material points to the more humdrum necessities of life, but that's housed in various catalogs and has not been considered of great interest.
Yeah. The scholarly tradition has tended to ignore that material.
Right. Well, there's so much of it. There's so much of it. Let's say even just pottery.
Yeah.
And how do you classify it? Basic kitchenware doesn't change from reign of emperor to reign of emperor. So mm-hmm. if you can't date it, you know, there's no artist or manufacturer's name, and it's so ordinary that it doesn't appeal
yeah.
to the academic mind, I suppose.
Does your research also then represent a break with the way these kinds of objects have been traditionally studied by art historians apart from classicists?
Well, I think so. What I tried to do in the Roman Women book is use both examples of high art, the Egyptian Fayum portraits, marble statues, jewelry, you know, the types of things that would be in the glass cases in the museum,
yeah.
and the more ordinary ivory combs, instruments of adornment, makeup cases, and tried to do more with them than what has been done in the past, particularly objects made to stand for, mm-hmm. to just illustrate a social movement, everyday life. But I tried to take the more humble or plebeian objects and look at them seriously as if they were works of art. And I tried to take the higher works of art and investigate them as objects of social interest.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to readdress the balance.
I notice you don't always take things at face value, particularly literary texts, but also various sculptural programs, for instance.
Well, I think what I'm interested in is different genres or traditional types.
Mm-hmm.
In the introduction of the book, I think I mentioned for evidence of women's life is, of course, not produced for the most part by women,
yeah,
but by their fathers, men, leaders of the state, etc. So what you have, for example, in literature, you have satires of Juvenal, right,
yeah,
that portray women as schemers, deceiving their husbands, spending their money, wanting to rule households in every way possible, and demean their husband's authority. And the literature is rife with these stereotypes, you know, figures out of a modern situation comedy. Inept dowagers, matrons who have no outlet for their sense of ambition. Whereas if you wander through the Roman roads leading out of any ancient town, you see tombs and inscriptions that praise honorable women, good,
yeah,
wives and mothers who stay home and make wool. And these will often be of the same historical period. So how do they jive? You know, different genres in literature. Here we have a marble inscription honoring the dead, or these racy satires. You know, it's,
yeah,
different conventions. The,
yeah,
funerary epitaph is to honor, to praise, to laud, whereas satire is for social control, to warn against upstarts or what's perceived as a phenomenon,
yeah,
that might be, go over the edge.
One of the passages you focus on in the beginning of the book, prominent in Roman literature and history, is the story of the rape of the Sabines that constitutes one of the foundation myths of the Roman Empire, which you remark provides a blueprint for Roman attitudes toward women, marriage, and the wider political and military culture of Rome. And I wonder if you could talk about this.
Well, the rape of the Sabine women is seen as central and fundamental as a document for the relationship between men and women in Rome. But it's also one of these interesting stories that, of course, has wide repercussions for how Romans view themselves, their foundations, and their right to rule, to have world dominion, a kind of global empire. And there are various versions of it reflected in Roman poetry and early historical writing. Romulus and the first founders of Rome need wives. Early Rome is made of a band of, let's face it, misfits,
yeah,
criminals, wanderers, and they have a festival and invite the neighbors, particularly those with lovely young daughters, the Sabines from the northeast hills of Rome, to come. And at a planned moment in the festivities, Romulus makes a signal, and his band of unruly men carry off these young Sabine maidens, abduct them,
mm-hmm,
and keep them hostage as Rome. So it's traditionally in feminist literature of an earlier date, let's say 70s to 80s, it's often seen as women as object,
yeah,
as intermediary. But in various tellings of Roman authors, it takes a few twists, because early on, Romulus speaks to the captive maidens and tells them how his men, Romans, honor marriage highly, and that there are both responsibilities and privileges of being a Roman wife and matron, and that they should consider this. And it seems after their initial period of terror, they do. And at some point later, the women then internalize Romulus's ideas about the benefits of Roman civilization, so much so that at a later date, when the Sabine fathers and husbands or brothers, the menfolk, come to release their women from,
mm-hmm,
captivity, you know, to fight back,
yeah,
the Romans, what happens is, in various tellings of the myth, the Sabine women intercede and put their bodies in between their Roman husbands and the Sabine fathers and brothers and plead to them to stop,
yeah,
this fighting. So they work for peace and a settlement, a renegotiation, which of course is in Rome's favor. So women are knitting the bonds between these warring factions, right? And
then it seems to become a sort of paradigm then for the way Rome,
yes,
relates to the peoples it conquers in terms of assimilation.
Right, right. It? Through marriage, you become relations,
yeah,
right? So the family is seen as a microcosm of empire.
Oh.
And it's a very nice story because it does ideological work. So the real bloodshed, the gore, and the brutality of Roman dominion is kind of erased,
yeah,
in this story. And these women are then made to seem to have a stake in Rome,
yeah,
to be proud, and to want to be Roman.
Elements of the story remind me a bit of the story of Marcius Coriolanus, his wife
and mother, right? He is outside of Rome. He's outside of Rome, threatening to attack.
Yeah,
and
he's
again,
been
the
banished,
women.
Yeah.
Yes, I think wife and mother, women folk come and they talk to him and they stop him from doing violence.
And that's an
onto
historical event.
Yes.
Yeah,
so there is, and particularly in later historical periods, it's elite women, mm-hmm. wives, mothers of senators, of the political class, right, of those who have stake. They perform political work. And they are sage counsel, advisors to their sons, even to their husbands. At the same time, of course, Roman women, and like Greek women, are citizens, and they have some rights. However, they're excluded from the main focus of society, in that, of course, they can't serve in the military, and they can't have any political positions.
Yeah.
So that they're not sheltered in the household, as we think Greek women, but they're not given a political voice.
Yeah.
However, time and time again, the literature says that particularly the mature matron is given lots of responsibility for the education of young and for matters in the household. And there are times when she is an advisor, you know, off stage, behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But in some ways is indirectly tied to the political scene.
You mentioned in the book that women also participate in the religious life of Rome.
Oh, yeah, this is important. And for this, there are some precedents with Greece. You know, Rome and Greece are there, are knit closely together. And that in the Greek world, although women are thought to be particularly sheltered to home and household, they did have a public life and religion. And Roman women, the same, if not more. So particularly women who came from the elite or were affluent could become priestesses.
Mm-hmm.
And in Rome, since it was a state religion, being a priestess was like having a quasi-official function. One could be a priestess and be married and have children. There would be no problem with that. And it would require them to be kind of organizational women, to be outside of the household at the temple and the shrine, organizing events, procession, feasts, charitable occasions. In Roman religion is one in which the temple was a house for the god or goddess, and the god and goddess was embodied by a statue, marble, bronze, and at different feast days, the statue would be washed, dressed, anointed, jeweled, sometimes carried around, given gifts, you know, offerings would be left at it. So there would be certain cults that were considered women's cults, although some women could have some role in other cults. And I'd like to think of some of these priestesses as serving the functions as akin to society matrons who run charity balls and those type of functions and put their money and their social talents at networking.
So the Romans don't make the distinction that we do between civic life and religious
institutions. They were since it was a state religion, and much of the state religion was to ask the gods' help for the state's benefits, to bring Rome victory, to safeguard the emperor, the troops, to bring in the food, the harvest, to feed the Roman population, etc. And I should say, though, in certain fundamental points, as in the public sphere, women could not have political positions per se or serve in the military. Even in religion, some of the bloodletting, the sacrifices, and important offerings could not be done by women. But there were other roles and other cults in which they could fully participate. And just being out and about, leading a procession, doing some of these activities with, you know, statues being carried around, they would be highly visible in their society, fully dressed and adorned, and it would give them a kind of prestige.
Yeah.
There were earlier parts in the Republic in which we know that there were sumptuary laws against very wealthy women in the early Republic who would travel around in the city in highly adorned carriages, etc., and wearing bejeweled clothing, etc. And one imagines a competition between these elite matrons.
Yeah.
And they would also travel with their entourage, we might call them security guards, servants, etc. So these women just entering a forum or a market with their huge crowd of retainers would create a stir. Crowds would part. People would look at them, especially if they were wearing glittering jewelry and silk robes and have fabulous carriages or means of conveyance. So early in the Republic, there were attempts to stop this. And it would be an affirmation of status, who they were. And at times, women attempted to regain some of these privileges back because it's akin to male honors in the military.
I know Roman society was adamantly patriarchal, and it was also a strictly stratified and highly regulated society in terms of social rank, etc. So can you tell us about what kinds of activities Roman women could ordinarily engage in that might seem surprising to us, and in what ways Roman women might be constrained that might also seem surprising to us?
Well, marriage was arranged, except for the lowest levels of society. So we think that in our contemporary society, in most of the world, not entirely, that in the Western world, perhaps I should say, that young women can pick their own husbands, or relatively free
and
in their romantic
affairs.
Yes, but yes, this was not the case for much of Rome. Men married at about the age of later 20s. They had to have a military career, mainly for the elite, and be moving on into a political career. And if their father was still alive, average life expectancy was much lower, so there were fewer white-haired Romans around, although some did make it to the age. If the young man's father was alive, of course, he would have a great say and could nix a choice of a bride. For the woman, she would be relatively younger, if the elite as young as 13 to 15, if not a little older. And clearly, these would be sheltered girls of limited education or almost no education, and the marriage would be arranged among good families, let's say, for political alliances, for senatorial affairs, for business interests, for a variety of reasons. So these young women would be little more than adolescents, moving into another household where probably there'd be a mother-in-law, and she would have to learn how to manage one of these households, kind of completely innocent of the world. Now, then, if marriages were arranged like that, divorces were also rather easy. All that divorce required is that the man and wife agreed to it, announced that they would be divorced, and the woman could go back home to her father. If she was guilty of adultery, the family would have to leave part of her dowry with her husband.
Yeah.
You know, that would be that she betrayed her vows. She could take most of her dowry back, depending on how long she lived. Some of her dowry might be used as capital for the husband's estate.
Yeah.
So they would dicker over money, but divorces were free and easy to arrange. And if you think some of these young girls, 14, 15, being married, their fathers, their parents could recall them. And this happened. We know them from the writings of Cicero and others, not because the couple didn't get along or weren't happy or couldn't produce a child. And of course, the point of marriage was reproduction, producing children, particularly male heirs for these families. But the divorce could be arranged because the bride's father would prefer to marry her to someone else whose family was more important for his political career. So brides were brokered. Again, we think of the rape of the Sabine women. We provide links among prime households, among, you might say, the blue blood of Rome. And so there were serial marriages. Many were married many, many times, you know, more so than contemporary Hollywood.
Did women control their own property at all?
A good question. Yes, they could. On the lower levels of society, you might have a woman run a mom-and-pop shop. They might run a little shoemaking shop or a vegetable stand, and of course she could.
Yeah.
On the elite society, women had to have guardians who would control their legal interests. They could be free of guardianship if they married and they had at least a certain number of children, and there were various ways to get around. There was a fiction of a legal guardian in order to buy and sell property if they inherited estates or land, townhouses from their father. They would need this guardian to approve it. But in reality, they controlled their own accounts. And you have, and because of demographics, there have been interesting studies, because you have many of these fathers and husbands dying relatively young. So you have women in control, women outliving their husbands and their fathers. So, of course, they might have had a guardian, a kind of lawyer type in the wings, but they would manipulate him, they could get around him. So they were managing family fortunes, businesses. For the elite, money was in landed wealth, estates outside of Rome, worked by slaves. So, yes. There's also interesting documentation. You know, we have our literary sources. I mentioned Juvenal, Cicero, the Augustan historian Livy on the foundations of Rome, the poetry of Ovid, also Augustan. But literary sources give you mythic foundations, high history, habits of the elites, right? But There's also an interesting body of literature that's come to light more lately, and that's from Roman Egypt, where in the dry desert climate, caches, libraries, documents on papyri have been found in Roman Egypt, which was, you know, conquered by Augustus, but later, first century AD throughout, became, you know, a thriving Roman province. The overflowing of the Nile allowed for a good harvest that was sent to Rome. And what we do find in these papyri of Roman Egypt, legal documents, lawsuits, lists, business, rents, letters. And there's a group at Columbia University who've published recently letters by and from women. Often the husbands would be in the main city, Alexandria, on the Mediterranean, and they'd have estates in the Fayum, an oasis with lake and canals, and the women would be there managing the family estates, which would produce all kinds of agricultural produce that would then be shipped and sold. And we have letters from husband to wife that tell of caring of children, planning weddings. So all the everyday, which you won't find in the high literary culture that we tend to have preserved. Yeah. And in that, we also, in the letters from Roman Egypt, we have accounts of women traveling alone to funerals. You know, you wouldn't think they would travel alone. They should have at least a slave, a male slave, a guardian, someone to protect them. Travel, brigands, you know, ruffians on the road in all parts of the empire, it was always dangerous. But we have accounts of women in motion, doing business, taking charge of the family when the husbands are at war, when they're away on business, in a way that profoundly changes our idea of Roman women and their agency.
Some of those letters seem very contemporary. I mean, there's one that you quote from the wife of a soldier who is away, and she's worried about his safety.
Yes, there's an uprising in Alexandria under... Why did you read the letter?
Okay. Alina to my dear Apollonius, many greetings. I am very worried for you on account of the things that people reported about what is happening and because you left so suddenly. I take no pleasure in food and drink, but always stay awake night and day with only one thought, your safety. Only my father's care revives me, and I lay without eating on New Year's Day, until my father came and forced me to eat. I beg you, therefore, to look after your safety, and not to face danger alone without a guard, but do the same as the strategos here who put the burden on the magistrates.
Okay. Well, the governor of a province uses his entourage, his officials. Like, he doesn't go out and risk himself, so she's asking her husband to use the privilege of his position not to be in harm's way. I found it also interesting that her father visits her and begs her to eat. You know, we think that's more of a motherly concern. So that's kind of interesting that fathers do look after their married daughters, even when they're out of their households. Yeah. So it's an interesting tie.
Now, you have a chapter devoted to the subject of marriage and the family in Roman culture, and since the family unit for the Romans represents a kind of microcosm of the state, as you've said, does this place a burden on Roman women to bear a certain iconic responsibility they are expected to uphold by embodying and being models for various important virtues?
Well, yes, and we see this particularly in the funerary epitaphs on tombstones. And the phrase that appears over and over again across time is that so-and-so was a good wife and mother, and it says, lanum fecit. She stayed home and she made wool. And, you know, whether she wove, spun thread, made her own garments or not, it doesn't matter. We also have the historian Suetonius, in the Lives of the Caesar, tells us that Augustus's wife, Livia, and the women of the household made his own garments. You know, this shows that they had a traditional virtue. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, various very different activities were going on, and his daughter was accused of all kinds of riotous sexual behavior beyond the norms. So wool work became synonymous with feminine virtue.
Yeah.
Chastity in the sense of modesty for a matron who had married and have children, and also a kind of industriousness, you know, that is, if a woman's hands were always working her spindle and distaff, she would be out of trouble. And there's mythic allusions to it. It goes back to, you can think in Greek culture, to Penelope and the suitors, right, weaving and unweaving. Yeah. And since Rome is a rustic culture, the wife also has a role as a provider in the sense that she transforms or processes agricultural material.
The wool
from the sheep has to be cleaned, processed, woven. And so it becomes a kind of old-time, wholesome activity.
Yeah.
I think I had a phrase in the book, and then I thought maybe it was too trendy. And think of kind of the Martha Stewart phenomena, or even those, you know, Living Simple magazines that one should eschew the conveniences of our consumer culture, the fast food, the processed this, and go back and make traditional meals, make things from scratch, with simple, wholesome ingredients. Now, of course, who can do that? Only the elite. Right, to buy the expensive olive oil or, you know, the deluxe produce and grocery items and bake your own bread, bake from scratch. Very few people, women, have the leisure and time, energy to do that. So it becomes an elitist activity. So this, I think this notion of wool work, of course, many Romans wives did that out of necessity. But we do know that from the papyri of Roman Egypt, there are texts that say that the wool from a household was sometimes sent out to workshops and was made and brought back to them. And professional weavers were male.
Oh, that's
right. And even organizations, there's a weaving industry. There's records for it in Pompeii in southern Italy and Roman Egypt. And there it's male.
Yeah.
But in this, the ideology of the good matron, the virtues, it's woman's work.
Yeah.
And in a court, in the atrium, the courtyards of Roman houses, you'll find loom weights. Mm-hmm. And various other spindles of the household.
Yeah.
So a matron may have set up looms in the afternoon for weaving in the atrium court of her household after the men have gone.
Yeah.
And she might have supervised slaves. If you think about everyday life, you can do some weaving and spinning, you know, when you're looking after children. Not all of it demands a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Some of that working with the wool you can do while you're doing other domestic tasks.
And you mentioned part of the ceremonies around the marriage ritual.
Yes.
The bride's required to spin?
Well, there's stories, and the Roman wedding is interesting because we don't have good contemporary accounts.
Yeah.
We have poetic evocations. We have some legal information. But from different ceremonies, you have to patch together.
Yeah.
From different parts of the ceremony, from different times. So it's hard to say exactly what they did at any given time.
Yeah.
But weaving, the bride was allegedly supposed to work her wedding tunic or gown on a very traditional, old-fashioned loom, as if this would give her practice for the life that lay ahead or was a kind of ritual test. And wool, fat from wool smeared on the post of the house and various weaving equipment accompanied her on the procession from her father's house to the house of her husband, etc. So, yes, wool was associated, I think, with both the purity and the sense that the marriage would be productive, that she would be a good keeper of her husband's stores, that she would help enrich him by processing the agricultural, the material that he would bring into the house through his labors. And then, of course, that she would produce the children. That was the purpose of marriage.
One of the more touching images that you have in the book, I thought, was the work basket, the woolen work basket.
Oh, yes.
That's also a tomb, a funerary tomb.
Right. So, yeah, so that a woman's ashes then were, you know, work basket, which would never be from her side, but it would be a marble version of a work basket, so a more monumental and costly form.
Yeah.
So even in death, a woman is enshrined in a container that represents her daily tasks.
Yeah.
You know, we would say busy work, but this, for them, that would be productive and upstanding work for a woman to do.
Did Roman girls receive any kind of structured education?
No, not really. It's thought, this is again, Pliny the Younger left us letters early in the late first century CE, early second to the reign of Trajan, and there are little glimpses. There are tutors in the household for elite young men. This is in the highest households. The girls may be allowed to sit in on the lessons to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be, you know, Latin, and these young men would be taught Greek, and they would have to learn to read some of the Greek epic, etc. So they were allowed to be present at the lessons. But there is a tradition of the matrona docta, the literary or refined, highly educated matron. But across the boards, no structured education.
Yeah.
I think some of the senatorial families would educate their young girls because it was a family tradition to make them stand out so that they would be articulate, knowledgeable. In some cases, Pliny talks about his young wife as listening into his speeches and as being musical. Sometimes some of that, you know, the 19th century salon culture of women being artistic or musical as to give them a polish on a fine education might be that. But rudimentary education, generally the satirists and the kind of conservatives would say education would be a dangerous thing for a woman, you know?
There is one of the Fayum portraits that you include is of a teacher, Hermione, though.
And that's a very interesting one because it has her name in Greek, and grammatike, which should indicate teacher. And it's controversial about what that means.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a Fayum portrait, so it's painted on the linen mummy wrapping. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these portraits were on thin wood panels that were put over the head of the mummified remains of a skeleton. This is actually on the linen itself. And there are bones underneath.
Mm-hmm.
These were scanned. And she was a young woman, I think, between the ages of 18 and early 20s, so young. And there was lots and lots, yards and yards, or meters and meters of linen finely wound around this mummy. It was rather expensive.
Yeah.
So she was mourned appropriately, or more than appropriately. She must have been well-beloved and honored by her family. And so there's scholarly arguments whether grammatike, was she a school teacher? And in Roman Egypt, there's a kind of a prestige with that because Roman Egypt was a multicultural society. And these Fayum portraits on the mummy show this in that the bodies are mummified in the tradition of Old Kingdom Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nowhere else in the Roman Empire would they be mummified. But the portraits, either on the linen wrappings or on those thin wood boards over the faces, show us faces that look very much like marble portrait sculpture from the center of Rome, the capital city, except that they're brightly painted. The women have similar hairstyles and jewelry. So they appear to be very Roman, metropolitan, urbane.
Yeah.
However, then we have the Greek inscriptions, because these people spoke Greek. You may ask why, and that's because after the death of Alexander the Great, his generals ruled that part of the world, and there was a Greek culture. You know, they were Greek culturally, linguistically. You know, Cleopatra would have spoke Greek, because she knew other languages too. And some of these mummy casings, you know, they're references to or allusions to Greek goddesses, Aphrodite. But the funeral ritual, that is the way of preserving the body, goes back to Old Kingdom Egypt.
Yeah.
So you have layers of Egyptian, Greek, and then Roman culture. And of course, by the period of Augustus, through the early 3rd century, they were living under a Roman administration, a Roman military presence, paying tribute and tax money to Rome. Although Latin, as the Roman language, never infiltrated because there was such a strong level of Greek culture. So in these towns that were very Greek, there were gymnasia, which were more like universities or prep schools, in which the elite young men of these towns in Roman Egypt enrolled.
Mm.
And they would come to manhood with a firm Greek education that was one of the gymnasium, both of body and mind. So there was a proud assumption of this Greek heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not sure, long story short, if Grammatica was a Greek school teacher, but in Roman Egypt that may have been more prestigious than just someone who's correcting the bad Greek and grammar and doing the, you know, trots with her students or something more. But it's interesting that with her name, it's right after her name is a label.
Yeah.
So one assumes she wanted to be remembered that way,
you know,
and she is.
Yeah. The portraits in general, the Fayum portraits, are rather amazing for anyone who's never seen them because they're they're such striking examples of portraiture. Presumably, they attempt to capture what the person actually looked like, and certainly they give you a lot of detail about clothing and jewelry.
Right. And it's interesting, these mummy portraits have languished, you know, in a scholarly oblivion, because Egyptologists, those who are looking back at ancient Egypt, tend to go to old, middle, new kingdom, ancient Egypt, the Egypt of the pharaohs, right, of the pyramids and so forth. And these mummy portraits, as I said, date to late 1st century B.C. to about 3rd century A.D., so the period of Roman occupation. They've been collected avidly from the 19th century, the Hermione Grammaticae portrait, think it's in Girton College, the British archaeologist Flinders Petrie, some of the Italians. So in the late 19th century, people were fascinated by them. But in more recent years, they've been seen by the Egyptologists as Egyptian art under Roman rule. Like, they thought them as sort of bad Roman provincial art, and no one was interested in them. And scholars who do Roman art and archaeology, like me, look to marble sculpture, you know, not painting. A painting is the Pompeian painting on the walls of houses, which is mythological, landscapes. So they fell between the cracks of scholarly disciplines. For me, seeing them, it's the color, the vividness. And they are so well preserved in that dry climate, as I said, on wood boards or the linen mummy wrappings, because although we know the marble portrait sculptures for which the Romans excelled were painted, most of the paint is gone. So you have that clean white marble. And there was a wonderful exhibition organized by the British Museum 7, 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, called Ancient Faces. And they gathered, they have a wonderful collection in London, and they gathered other works, and this exhibition traveled. And a wonderful catalog is published by Susan Walker and Morris Beerbrier, and that brought my attention to it. And I think it gave more scholarly credibility to these works. But it's the vivid color, the shading. I think, and I illustrate some of these in my book, makeup is seen on these faces. Jewels, and it's the same kind of jewels you would find in Pompeii in southern Italy from the first century A.D., and hairstyles. They look strikingly like individuals with features, heavier faces, not all fashionable beauties with distinct marks. Interesting. We don't know. What we do know is that to mummify, I think, took about 70 days. So one wonders if there was a death. There are many sudden deaths of young people. Would an artist go to watch the body while it was being embalmed or mummified, I should say, and was a portrait made then? Other scholars have thought that some of the little wooden portraits, the boards inserted over the face of the mummy, might have been portraits in the house that were then carried in the funeral procession and then inserted in the mummy. Yeah. We do have one wooden board in Greek, little scribblings about colors, kind of a memo to artists about what to do. The only thing I would caution that I think the painted Fayum portraits of Roman Egypt show us, I'm not sure it so much as individuals, but you do see types. Matrons, maidens, young soldiers, people shown according to social role. But what's most interesting, I should say, is that when you have the whole mummy, you have the skeletal structure. So they did this for the British exhibition. They took some of the skeletons and looked at them for age. And in fact, there's one case, I think, in which they gave the skeletal remains to a forensic artist who worked for Scotland Yard, but didn't show the forensic artist the actual painted portrait, and they asked him to do a portrait based on the skeletal remains. I mean, this is a forensic artist who would do this for victims of crimes, you know, remains of bodies seen in brutal attacks, and what did the victim look like? He would be able to draw up a design or a sketch, or sometimes even sometimes doing a plaster sculpture of it. And they didn't want him to see the painted portrait because, it, of course, it might influence him. And then when he finished, the forensic artist finished his work, they showed him the portrait, and it was the painted mummy portrait that they'd taken off. And it was alike, except that in the painted Fayum portrait, the face was slightly thinner, nose slightly less strong, slightly idealized, which is interesting. So the artist improved features somewhat according to their conventions of beauty.
Interesting.
But it's, you know, because usually we have busts, images of ancient Romans, but we don't have the bodies. So you can't check against physical type, or at least even bones or remains. So I find that fascinating. And since they're painted on the wooden boards in encaustic wax, in which pigment is melted, there's a wonderful texture, and they reflect the light and glow.
There's, there's a depth to them, certainly.
Now,
I know one of your specialties is Roman funerary sculpture. Young girls who died in Roman society before reaching adulthood seem to figure prominently in memorials for the dead, more so than young boys, it seems. And I wonder why this is the case, if you have any ideas.
Yes, that's interesting. And it's not that so many more young girls died, although one could say, given demographics, a lot of young people died, if not in the first year from childhood illnesses, the first 5 years. But also, I think it's that the promise of a young girl, of the grandchildren, the marriage, loom so large to parents that they were more inclined to commemorate. My book is on Roman women, so I focused on daughters. But there are also many grave memorials to young men of promise before they had their military career or took up positions in law courts and so forth. So it does look like that youth of Rome expired at a much faster level, but parents of some affluence, and not only the elite, but ex-slaves, freed people and businesses, did commemorate their young and kept their memory alive. And what's interesting, and often I look at funerary altars or tombstones in which you have an inscription, a name, the parent's name, or sometimes the age of the young woman, and then you have an image carved in relief, and sometimes the image projects the young woman as appearing older than she was at the time of death. So it gives that image, had not death intervened, she would have been a young wife and mother, reached full maturity, but if the age is listed, she never quite reached that. And in mythology, there's the topos of the maiden dying before her time, the idea in Greek myth of Persephone snatched away, abducted by Hades, where in return for this, she becomes queen of the underworld, but her, you know, a life is changed drastically, if not limited. So there is a kind of poetic touch to all of this.
Now, with regard to Roman girls, you have wonderful images in the book of wooden and ivory dolls that seem to have been a common possession of girls of a certain social strata of Roman society. They have movable limbs just like our own Barbie dolls and seem also to be fashioned to look a bit older, I expect, than a child who would have owned them. So can you speculate on what this tells you about Roman girls?
Well, what fascinated me is that in the one case, there are several of these. I wish there were more. Mm-hmm. I think they would be quite expensive. The ones we have tend to be of ivory, although ivory turns brownish and dark over time, so when they were excavated, they were thought to be wooden. Uh-huh. More commonly would be kind of rag dolls, little stuffed dolls, but they have disintegrated or disappeared, particularly in damp conditions. So the ivory dolls you mentioned do have jointed limbs, and they're not baby dolls. The rag dolls were baby dolls, and we do have a few examples from Roman Egypt in the dry climate of rag dolls that were baby dolls. But the ivory dolls, and there's several of them, not a lot. There's some from later antiquity in catacombs. But these ivory dolls are more like a Barbie in that they have mature figures, hips and breasts and movable limbs. And there's one in an example of a sarcophagus that was found in Rome from the mid-2nd century A.D., and we have an inscription of the girl's name who was buried with her doll and her sarcophagus, her box. And her name is Creparea Tryphaena. And she was youngish, probably no more than 17, 18. And when the sarcophagus, the coffin, was opened, it appears as if there's a skeleton of the girl was holding the doll at her side, and the doll appears to have been turned towards her. So, you know, the doll is her friend. The doll is buried with her, right? Accompanies her to the next world. Interesting, because there's a few scraps of late Latin that tells us that when girls reach maturity, when they become brides, they are to put their girlish, childish things away, and their dolls should be dedicated at a sanctuary of Venus. So they become brides, give the dolls to Venus. So this young girl was not married, so the doll accompanied her. She never had an opportunity to give her doll away, to dedicate it to her. And furthermore, the doll had, you know, the girl was buried in a box, the coffin. The doll had her own little box, a cosmetic box, we might say it, Barbie's accessories in a kit. And in there were very fine little silver mirrors, polished glow, and jewelry. And the girl was wearing this creperea, the dead girl, had a ring with a key on it in which to open the box of the doll. So there's a kind of identity of interests there of a girl. She may have been 17, 18, let's say a teenager, playing with a doll with an adult body. There were no clothes found, but little few scraps of fabric. The sarcophagus or coffin was found near the banks of the Tiber, so in a very humid environment. So the drapery deteriorated. But we assume that part of the play, right, this was, it'd be about play, the doll would be dressed and undressed, you know, look in her mirror, she would be done up, etc., getting ready for her day.
Literature and the archaeological evidence attests that many Roman women were keenly interested in cosmetics, hairdressing, bathing, perfume, jewelry, clothing, and personal beautification in general, and you rather enticingly pose a number of questions about how we might read this evidence. Do these objects enforce or efface social differences, for instance? Are they an avenue of personal expression, or do they serve as a repressive means to reduce the female body to the status of an object? And I wonder if you have any thoughts about the world of cosmetics and
What's most interesting about it is, of course, there's the brand of literature that gives voice to the conservative male authority, says that this is no good, right?
Yeah, painted women. Yeah.
Right, yeah, right. Women who pay too much attention and spend their husband's fortunes on jewels, fine fabrics, and adornment. And why would a woman want to get dressed up to be visible, to catch the attention of other men, to be unfaithful, to live outside of her household, yeah, to make a fool of her husband? So in archaeological finds, you find little pots and containers for makeup, equipment, and jewelry. And in fact, the poet Ovid gives us recipes for cosmetics, some of it punning, but you know, I think there's an element, there's a literature out there and a great deal of interest. So on the other hand, a woman's fine appearance would be important for her husband, you know, particularly for a woman who was of social position, where she had to accompany her husband to certain ceremonies, you know, even on religious or state occasions. So being well adorned and made up to a certain extent would be important. It would be a kind of, you know, her dress uniform.
Yeah.
Being well put together.
It might have a ceremonial significance then, say.
I think so. Well, you know, with some of the wigs and some of the portraits have elaborate architectonic hairstyles that would have been in high-piled crowns of hair,
yeah,
that we think would have been impossible to do without wigs, you know, artificial hair.
Yeah.
Without, you know, lots of maids, let's say slaves, primping their curling irons, etc. Poets tell us about German slaves providing blonde hair for wigs that was of interest to Mediterranean, you know, Romans. And all kinds of grueling remedies and tonics for the skin, yeah, as well, from cucumber juice to ass's milk and this and that. So there was a whole culture for maintenance of the body and rejuvenation. Yeah. And I think it represents a kind of women's world, you know.
Yeah.
And to get back to your question, some of the hairstyles may have been, in a way, akin to male adornment. Not helmets,
yeah,
but hair that looks like head coverings,
yeah,
or crowns or some kind of adornment that would be equivalent with rank or prestige.
Yeah, I wondered if this culture might have been as it was in my mother's time, when women used to give one another makeovers and permanents in their homes, a way for Roman women to participate in a sort of shared culture, share recipes.
Because a lot of it, well, like for the facials and the creams, yeah, and all that, it appears to have been homemade,
yeah,
and based on knowledge of herbal remedies. And this cuts both ways. I mean, there's a whole line of literature, you know, the misogynistic literature,
yeah,
that says that what do women do? Well, women use poisons to kill their men, to kill,
yeah,
people in their way, right? And this is in Robert Graves, like Claudius, you know, from Suetonius and Tacitus, the woman as poisoner schemer. That's how she gets her man, not,
yeah,
brutally, you know, with a cut of the sword, but by poisoning, of course, the food that she prepares lovingly in her kitchen. You know, that's the old topos,
yeah,
there. But, you know, besides poison, women use herbal remedies, I think, to heal.
Yeah.
There's some evidence of that. And for cosmetic purposes. So I think this is probably a lore, as you said, culture of women.
Yeah.
And one assumes that this would be one of the ways women connect and come together without the men folk,
yeah,
outside of official eyes. And in all aspects of culture where women congregate without men, that becomes an area of suspicion.
Yeah.
So I think that's how the notion of woman as poisoner comes about.
Yeah. With these remedies, women were associated with medical treatments, weren't,
right,
they? And
yeah,
they
herbal,
were midwives.
Midwives. We have a relief plaque from a tomb in Ostia, the port of Rome, which, mm-hmm, shows a woman delivering a baby. And the tomb is not on the woman who delivers the baby, but it's the midwife. There's an inscription say that a woman, Scribonia Attica, was a midwife. And she erected the tomb.
Uh-huh.
She paid for the tomb for her husband and her mother. And we have one terracotta plaque, a relief, showing a woman giving birth, not lying down, but seated on a chair. And the chair has the seat cut out. she's pushing down, which, of course, holistic medicine says is a much better way to be in labor than to be on your back with your feet up.
Yeah.
You know, gravity aids you if you're seated upright, pushing down. We know that, you know, in some cultures, women squat to give birth. And there's an assistant holding the woman giving birth by her shoulders, and there appears to be a midwife on a stool reaching with her hands between the woman's leg. And it's a very interesting little terracotta relief. It's flat, simplified, but the midwife has her back to us and turns around as if there was a snapshot. She's getting her picture. And the fact that the midwife is seated lower down, actually working, is of interest, because in the official art of Rome, the most important person, whether an emperor, a general, the senator giving a speech, would be the tallest, the highest, centrally positioned, evoking the crowd, right? All eyes upon him. Whereas this relief, the hierarchy of stature is reversed, whereas the person upon whose tomb the relief is decorating, the active person, the person in charge, is lowest down, reaching with her hands, you know, underneath this woman to help her give birth. But yet the figure is turned around as opposing for a snapshot, you know, one would think. So I think interesting, and there are some texts of the period that talk about midwives having some knowledge and education, not being filled with superstition, and that their hands, their touch is most important in their care. And the relief actually shows her reaching, you know, for the woman. But what's also interesting for this tomb in a cemetery at Ostia, the port of Rome, is that the flanking terracotta plaque shows a surgeon. So we think is that the midwife says she has a husband in her inscription and her mother. We don't know if her mother was a midwife and she learned the craft from her, the two. But the husband, would he be a surgeon, and would they be a dual career couple in the medical arts?
Oh, that's interesting.
And his relief, it's fragmentary, but half of it shows two men on a stool, and one man has his foot in a basin, and we think the surgeon is leaning over. Looks like he may be cutting a boil or something, which the fluid is being released in a basin. And then next to them, of interest, is a huge case of sharp objects, medical instruments. But what's interesting is in the relief sculpture, the case of medical instruments, the scalpels from the doctor's kit, are over scale. They're twice as large as the figures, you know, the man whose boil is being lanced. So it's kind of odd. It's, you know, it's not naturalistic. And does the surgeon get his power from his sharp knives? Right? And the midwife has little investment in technology. It's her hand. It's her touch. You know, her personal care.
That's interesting. So, one last question, and this one is a bit philosophical, or at least historiographical. The great 19th century historian of the French Revolution, Jules Michelet, once wrote in an often cited and, I would say, very haunting passage of his preface to the history of France that he was driven to write history by the ghosts of the people of France who lived and died without their voices ever being heard, and that these ghosts inhabited the archives out of which he reconstructed the records of their lives. And you also talk in your introduction about giving the women of Rome the attention they merit and restoring their silent voices to the historical record. And although you are much farther removed from your subjects than was Michelet from the souls he believed his project might reanimate, many of the objects you deal with, like the Fayum portraits and the personal objects from the home, still provoke a sense of immediacy or an intimate connection with their former owners. So my question is, do you, as you're working with this material, ever feel moved to try to get it right, not so much for the sake of history, but for the sake of these women who once lived and whose presence you are trying to recall? I mean, do you ever have a sense of human connectedness or sisterhood with the women you study, or do you ever think of your work as a matter of building a kind of historical solidarity with them? And I ask this because your book does have an air of solicitude and intimacy in the way you imagine these women and the past they inhabit.
Well, I think, yes, of course, I'm attracted to this material, clearly, and I want to approach it with care. And in my previous work, I've looked at either funerary art, memorials to the dead, particularly those who are not of the elite classes, not of the makers of history, you know, not those that the Suetonius, the historians, would ever bother to write about. So, of course, and portraits, you know, these are images, testimonies of lives lived, particular personalities whose names we don't have, of which we know very little. So always I'm aware of how little we know about them, and at the same time how deceptive the evidence can be. But of course, yes, I approach them with certain care, there are times in which, you know, emotions that I do feel strongly about them, that the doll on the arms of the girl's skeleton, these tomb reliefs of young women described as dulcissima, the most sweet, the most dear, right? And, you know, moments of great loss are recorded on some of these funerary stones by parents who would invest more than a year's earning in these memorials. And I'm always keenly aware in the funerary, some of the Fayum portraits that take care that someone's image or name is recorded, that, of course, in my act of scholarship and research, I am fulfilling that promise that the dead shall be remembered, their names, their images.
So I'd like to thank you, Eve, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today and sharing your thoughts on your book with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
We've been talking with the art historian and professor of art, Eve Dombra, today on the Library Cafe about the subject of her new book, Roman Women, published this year by Cambridge University Press. Tune in next week when we will be talking with Elizabeth Paravicini, professor of Hispanic Studies here at Vassar College, about her book, Creole Religions of the Caribbean, From Voodoo and Santeria to Obeah and Espiritismo.